My name is Linda Dean Goolsby. I'm 65, and today's date is March 20th, 2008. We are in Abilene, Texas. I'm going to do some remembrances of my parents, particularly my father. My father's parents named him Talmage Whitman Dean, but his older brothers and sisters thought that was a terrible name for a baby, so they decided to call him Jack, and the name stuck for the rest of his life. He was named for the 19th century preacher and author Thomas DeWitt Talmage, and the governor of New York, Charles Talmage. None of us really know why. He grew up in Russellville, Tennessee, and moved to El Paso, Texas to work for his brother, Hal Dean, in the grocery business. It was there he met my mother, Frances Sibley, on the steps of the First Baptist Church. She was 15 years old, and he was 19, and she was smitten. Eventually, he wanted to go to college. He was torn between studying music and aeronautical engineering, but the music won out. He first went to Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, where he sang in the college quartet. To earn his college money, he was hired to get up early in the winter and go to wealthy homes to light their fires so they could get up to a warm house. A little of that apparently went a long way. He soon came back to El Paso and Francis until the two of them enrolled at Hardin-Simmons University in Abilene, Texas in 1937. My grandmother had made a deal with Mother that if she would attend one semester as a single girl, Grandmother would allow her to get married. So, Frances Sibley enrolled, but on February the 18th, 1938, she became Frances Dean at last. They were quietly married in the preacher's house, with my father's roommate and my grandmother as witnesses. My father had smuggled his trunk out through the dormitory window to avoid the predictable bachelor hazing, and he had missed one class for his weekend honeymoon. He wrote a letter to his professor asking to be excused for his absence and promising never to use the same excuse again. Old friends have told me that they were very popular to double date with on campus. Because they were married, they counted as adult chaperones. So the other couples had a lot more freedom to go places with them. They graduated together in 1940. Jack was president of the student body, and Frances was the university queen. His next objective was a master's degree from the Eastman School of Music in Rochester, New York. He had not received his letter of acceptance by the time it was necessary to leave Abilene, since they were traveling by Greyhound bus. So they stepped out together in faith and arrived in Rochester to find out that, yes, he had been accepted. They rented a one-bedroom apartment and made ends meet by subletting the bedroom to their friend and fellow Abilenian, Macon Summerlin. Jack also played the organ at the local Episcopal church that year. The winter cold and snow was a shock to my mother. There was a small grocery store on the ground floor of their apartment building, so for 6 weeks in the dead of winter, she never went outside. There was 15 feet of snow that year, and she has a picture of my father walking down the sidewalk between two snowbanks that tower over his head. In the fall of 1941, they returned to Abilene, where my father was hired as an assistant professor of music theory and composition at their beloved alma mater, Hardin-Simmons. When World War II broke out, my father joined the Navy. As a lieutenant, he taught weather and navigation for the Navy at the University of Texas, and then at Stanford. My mother joined him in Palo Alto with their two toddler daughters and set up housekeeping. While she was moving in, she realized that her older daughter was missing from the front yard where I had been playing. A railroad track ran across the back of the lot, and she walked back and forth along the tracks, weeping and looking for her child. Finally, in desperation, they called the police, who asked, "Is she wearing a red shirt and blue pants? She's sitting here eating an ice cream cone." Turns out a police car had seen me playing alone and asked where I lived. Since we were just moving in, I had no idea. So they took me to jail. Mother always wondered why they didn't just come knock on the door and ask her if she knew me. Her biggest adventure or challenge occurred when the war ended sooner than expected. My father was to be part of the occupation forces and suddenly got his orders to ship out for Japan. They had to find a way to get Mother from Palo Alto to El Paso to stay with her mother until he returned. Not only did she have two toddlers, 18 months and 3 years, but she was also 8 months pregnant. The country's transportation system was swamped, but my father managed to get a sleeper berth for Mother right by the women's restroom. He gave her enough sea rations for the trip, and she planned to get off the train and go to Traveler's Aid if she went into labor anywhere along the way. She made it to El Paso in time to give birth to her third daughter, who was in fact not doing well. She had dysentery and required several transfusions. My father in San Francisco received an official notice giving him leave and saying, "Your daughter is dying." Not knowing which daughter, he rushed to El Paso as quickly as possible to find that her danger had passed. The doctors had finally found that she could keep down goat's milk. So back he went to San Francisco to rejoin his unit. He had left in such a hurry that his gear had shipped out for Japan with his unit, and one of the other men had taken it and stenciled his own name on the duffel. Eventually, my father got it back when he arrived in Japan. He was assigned to MacArthur's headquarters, but was not a fan of his arrogance and ego, so he volunteered to help set up the weather station in Korea. When he arrived, the Koreans were put off by the fact that he was speaking to them in Japanese, the language of their detested conquerors. Everyone warmed up, however, when he assured them that the Americans had learned Japanese to conquer them, not cooperate in occupying Korea. At first, the Americans were uncomfortable because the Koreans didn't have the same bathroom privacy requirements that Americans were used to. Women would have no qualms about using the men's room and vice versa. A solution was finally found. Mirrors were removed from the men's rooms, and women stopped using them. The Koreans he worked with earned his admiration for their dedication and hard work. They carried notebooks with them at all times, determined to learn English. His opinions were reinforced over the years as serious music students from Korea became his students. After the war, he returned to Hardin-Simmons to teach and eventually began working on his Ph.D., choosing between Eastman and the University of Southern California. I think my mother cast the deciding vote for sunny USC. It was another adventure. Because he had to attend in residence for a year, we all piled into the car and headed out for Los Angeles. They loaded the car with everything they might need for housekeeping, but couldn't find room for the mop. Finally, my mother said, "Let's just go," and put the mop in the front seat beside her. We carried a Coke box with ice and a Coleman stove to cook on and stopped at grocery stores along the way for supplies. There was no air conditioning in the car, so my parents timed the trip to have us driving across the desert at night. They were surprised to find out that most apartments in Los Angeles would not rent to families with children. So when they finally found a place with a kids okay sign in front, it turned out to be in Glendale, a long way from USC, and in a very poor neighborhood. My grandmother from Texas was so shocked by the conditions that she brought me home with her during that first summer because she was concerned about our neighbors. It was my first plane ride, too. We girls slept on army cots in the one bedroom, and our parents slept on garden furniture chaise lounges in the living room. I spent the third grade in Glendale and found that I was ahead of my California peers. I had been writing longhand in the second grade and was forced to go back to printing. My reading skills were enough ahead so that my teacher put me in charge of a reading group. Consequently, when I returned to Abilene for the fourth grade, I had to work very hard to catch up. We returned to California for several summers, with better luck on housing. I experienced my first earthquake. The house shook and all the neighborhood dogs howled. At first, I was asleep and thought my sister was kicking me in bed. We had an incinerator in the backyard where we burned trash, as did everyone else. It created very painful smog, much worse than today's. I saw my first television. I loved the puppet show Beanie and Cecil and began following Search for Tomorrow. Sure enough, 10 years later, I tuned into the show and the characters were still the same. I especially remember going to the Huntington Library and Museum and to the Hollywood Bowl to see the ballet Billy the Kid. Usually, our entertainments were free. We spent lots of time in libraries and parks. One of our favorite spots was Forest Lawn Cemetery, with its statuary and green lawns. We would pack a picnic lunch and go there often after church on Sunday. Once, my mother decided to take us girls to the beach. On our way home, she got stopped for speeding and tried to talk her way out of a ticket. She began to cry, and then all three of us began to bawl in the back seat. But the officer had no mercy. On the way home, she told us not to say anything to Daddy about the ticket until after supper. Well, of course, my middle sister blurted out the news immediately, and we all had a very strained supper. In 1956, our family saga continued when my father spent the summer doing research for his dissertation on 18th century organs in America. We drove across the South and then up to New England. We kids would explore the cemeteries around the churches that housed these old organs and saw the tourist sites everywhere, from Williamsburg to Maine. I was especially impressed by the tooth-pulling equipment that was in the Williamsburg dental office. We slept in our car at night, pulling into used car lots to blend in. By then, there were six of us, but my little brother could sleep in the window. Once, another car pulled into the lot also, which kept my father awake all night watching them. In the morning, they left, and he decided it was another family with the same idea. Every third night, we rented a motel room, and everyone had a real bath. Driving into New York City through the Holland Tunnel was a little scary for us kids. Finally, when we got to the end, a policeman flagged us over. My father didn't know what he'd done wrong and rolled down his window. But the officer leaned down and said, "Hey, Tex, need any help finding where you're going?" We felt welcomed to New York. My father ultimately became the dean of the School of Music at Hardin-Simmons. The local paper worked very hard not to have Dean Dean in the headlines on stories about him. He composed many choral works and affected the lives of many grateful students. We constantly hear back from those who have loved him in his lifetime. And we four kids feel extremely blessed to have had the parents that we did.
Did your parents ever tell you, or did they ever tell you where they considered their home to be?
Their home was always Abilene, because they spent most of their time here. Now, he, in 56, he left Hardin-Simmons and became head of the graduate music studies at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Fort Worth. And they stayed there for 9 years before he came back to Hardin-Simmons. But Abilene was the place where they considered home. They retired here out to the country and lived out on a ranch for a while before they finally moved back into town. I was living in California at the time, and my husband and I kept trying to convince them they should come out to California, but they wouldn't. Abilene was home.
Did they ever like to travel anymore once they had retired and settled down a bit, or did they just want to stay put in Abilene?
They just wanted to stay put, and they would come out to visit us occasionally, but they were always under the impression that 3 days was long enough. So they would drive out, stay 3 days, and drive back. And we would try to convince them, please stay longer. But they say, nope. Got to get back to the ranch, be sure everything's okay. So they did come back. I went on and did some graduate work at USC myself. And in 1992, I got a master's degree in communication. I worked for the phone company. And they came out for that graduation. And that was really wonderful. But mostly we had to come see them in Abilene because they liked being here. They had so many good friends that they had made in college and stayed all of their lives here in Abilene with them. And so they would have eating clubs where everybody would get together, play 42, and it was a wonderful experience for them. They were very happy here.
So you have, in all, you have 3 brothers and sisters?
I have 2 sisters and 1 brother.
Okay. And what kind of talks do you all have looking back on those times?
One of the things that's really funny is that all of us may remember the same event, but none of us remember it the same, which makes me wonder about... Well, maybe none of us actually has the truth. It's a combination of all, because we add to one another's stories. They say, oh, this happened. Well, this happened just before, and that happened just after, and she said this, and no, I said that. So they build on one another.
So what's one of those events that you all tend to have different stories of?
Oh, well, that's hard because you don't know it until it comes. Well, there is one, and I hesitate to say this because we had 2 cats. My husband and I had 2 cats when we were much, much younger. And something came up with my nephew when he casually said, oh, you had 2 cats who were named Shit-Ass and Snot-Nose. I said, what? And my husband said, are you kidding? Where did you get that idea? He said, no, you really did. And we said, no, we never did. What are you talking about? He says, yes, my mother told me that you did. So I went to my sister and I said, what do you mean telling him that? She said, well, that's true. You did have. I know you did. I said, we never had cats there. We would never name cats that. She said, oh, yes, you did. And the story, he had believed that story for 20 years, and it was totally, and she was convinced that it was true, but there was no truth in it whatsoever. And we have no idea where that came from.
So what is the truth?
The truth is we had two cats, and their names were Mouse and Little Kitty. And the only thing, and even that is giving her the benefit of the doubt, that at some point they were sick, and she must have been visiting us when they were sick, and came to the conclusion that that's what they should have been named, and so she named them that in her mind, and it carried over over the years. But the stories are really funny. We have my father's grandparents lived up in the mountains of Tennessee, and so we all have different remembrances of what that was like. Because they had no electricity, no indoor plumbing, and we all were familiar with the outhouse. And it's real interesting to compare the stories of the outhouse, because one of my sisters was afraid of it, and the other two of us were not afraid of it, but it was not terribly pleasant, and at night it was very cold. So my grandmother did have chamber pots under the beds. And we cannot really see chamber pots as decorative items because we have, in fact, used them in our young life. And we all know what priming the pump means because you had to prime the pump in order to get water. And for the Saturday night bath, we had a galvanized tin tub, which she set on the kitchen floor, heated the water on the stove, on the wood stove, and we all took our baths together, I guess in the same water as I think about it, on Saturday nights, and it was a big operation. My granddad, however, went down and lighted the stove so that when we got out of bed, we could run out of the cold bedrooms down into the kitchen, which was nice and warm, because he did that. He did that for us. So that was different. There aren't a lot of people today who actually remember an outhouse. Thank goodness.
So you have a lot of memories from when you were growing up.
Oh yes. Oh yes, indeed. I have one of the blessings of my family that I'm so grateful for is the kind of steadfast, honest people that they were. When I was 12 years old, I had just had my 12th birthday, and we were going to the drive-in. We went to the drive-in a lot. Actually, in those days, you could just load the car up and go to the drive-in on Friday night. You didn't have to worry about what the rating was of the movie. You knew your kids were going to be okay. And so we went on Friday, and as we're pulling into the theater, and I've just turned 12, and I say, you know, I'll squanch down in the back seat, and they'll never know that I'm actually 12 years old and will save the 50 cents. I can get in free. And my mother turned around, and she said, our honesty is not for sale for 50 cents. And they paid. I didn't really understand that at the time, but I have since learned to truly, truly appreciate it. And I remember when my grandmother died in the early 80s, and we were going to El Paso for her funeral because she was buried there with my mother's father, that my father, who had devoted his life to education and education in Christian colleges, so it was not real high paid, shall we say, was sitting there with his brother, who was in had been in the grocery business for years, and old friends who had been in the oil business for years, who had asked him to join them, and there were Uncle Fred, who was in the savings and loan business. And there were all these Cadillacs lined up at the restaurant, and our Dodge. And when we left the restaurant and got back to the motel, my father said to me, you know, maybe I made a mistake. Maybe I should have gone into the oil business, and it would have been so much easier on your mother, and you kids would have had so much more. Do you think I did the right thing? And I said to him, absolutely. There is no question that choosing the life of the mind and the life of affecting other people is the right choice. So I'm grateful.
Your mother's name was Frances?
Frances.
And she graduated alongside with your father?
Yes.
Did she ever want to go to graduate school? Or?
Well, she actually did.
She did.
Okay. She actually did. In fact, when she was over 60, she decided the time had come, and she went back and got a master's in English at Hardin-Simmons. And her professor said that she worked so hard in the class that he graded on the curve. And he had to just knock her out of the curve completely, because if he had left her in the curve, everybody would have made low grades. Because she was so... And she also decided she wanted to be a speaker. So she joined that organization that teaches you how to stand up and speak, and they meet every week.
Toastmasters?
Yes. She joined the Toastmasters. And she was very frustrated because she said, those young people do not know what makes a funny joke. That they would stand up and tell a joke, and she said the punchline would just be a swear word, or there wouldn't be a punchline. And she didn't understand why they thought this was funny. So one of her speeches was on what makes a good joke and how to tell it, because she knew her stuff. She was a writer. She wrote a book of poems called Bible Women Speak, and she worked on it for a long time, in which she wrote a poem on various women of the Bible from their viewpoint, and had that published for us kids as a collection. And so we still have that and appreciate that. When she was, my father was the musician and wrote music and large cantatas and oratorios and the whole thing. But she entered a songwriting contest for herself without telling him. And she won a national prize. It was a separation of church and state contest. She won first prize, and they flew her back east for the award. And she, Coretta Scott King, and the senator from Oregon, I've forgotten his name, were there on the podium with her, and the choir sang it. And it was Liberty, That Sweet Word Sounding. And she was so proud of herself, and my father was so surprised. And when she came back, the two of them then began collaborating on hymns, and she would write the words and he would write the tunes to go with it. And that collection, in fact, all of his music is collected at Hardin-Simmons in the music library there, and can still be ordered from them. He gave them all the copyrights. So for several years, the two of them wrote hymns together.
That's incredible. Is there a moment that you can remember growing up and seeing your parents' marriage? Is there an event or a moment in which they interacted with each other that perfectly characterizes their relationship? Or not perfectly.
I don't do anything perfectly. They had a very old-fashioned relationship from their generation. He believed that he was to take care of her and protect her and look out for her. And it was his responsibility to take care of the whole family. And she felt that as a wife, he was the boss, and she would always do what he said, which sounds worse than it is, because in fact his interest was concern for her and for the family. It wasn't for himself. So she could certainly do that. And I know my friends in high school used to laugh when they would ask my mother if I could do something, and she would say, well, I'll have to ask her father. Well, I'll have to be sure I can take the car. Well, I'll just have to ask her father if we can do this, that, or the other. The interesting and the one time in my experience when she did something different, our church was taking a big busload of the teenagers to the Grand Canyon. And the kids had been working on this and just getting so excited about this. And they'd been talking about it for a month, and everybody was just thrilled. Well, the cost was $35. And my mother and father had said, we can't afford it. You cannot go with them. And on the Sunday morning, when the bus was sitting in front of the church, and all the kids were packed and getting on, and I was standing there just real sad, my mother said, you know, we'll find the money somewhere. And we rushed home. Fortunately, she had done the laundry the day before. So I had clean clothes, but they weren't ironed. We threw clothes in the suitcase. She drove me back to the church and put me on the bus. And she said, I'll explain it to your father when he gets home. That turned out to be one of the most exciting times that I ever had. It was just really fun. And I've often wondered how she explained that to my father when he got home and I was gone for a week and a half to the Grand Canyon. So she was very traditional wife, but there were times. Another time was when I graduated from high school. I was barely 18, and I didn't want to go to college yet. And I decided I wanted to be a stewardess. And so my mother says, all right, we'll go over to Amon Carter Field, and we'll just, you know. I said, that's what I want to do. So I went from one airline to the next, and I said, do you hire stewardesses? That's what they were called then, at 18. And they all said, no, you have to be 21. You have to be 21. So I got to the end of the line, and there was a little airline called Central Airlines. They flew Texas, Oklahoma, Colorado, and Arkansas, and Missouri. And I said, do you hire people who are 18? And they said, yes, we do. So I said, let me have an application. So I filled out the application and turned it in and went home, and I got called in for an interview. Now, I have to say that I probably would not have hired me because, you know, I talk about wet behind the ears. But the head of the stewardesses was on vacation, and the head of the pilots was interviewing for stewardesses, and he hired me. That poor woman who was head of stewardesses just had a terrible time trying to teach me how to do my hair the way it needed to be done. And, you know, every time she got on the plane to grade me, something was wrong. She worked awfully hard, but I can just visualize her conversation with that pilot. Don't ever do that again. I was there for 6 months, and then I was ready to go back to school. But that was another quite adventurous thing. My daughter-in-law asked my mother one time, why in the world did you let her do that? My mother would have died. And my mother said, well, I didn't think they'd hire her, but when they did, I couldn't go back on my word. So that's the kind of person she was. Now, the kind of person my father was, he was fascinated by my flying. He kept track of everywhere I was. And he would occasionally look up and say to my mother, "Oh, it's 5:30. Linda is landing in Fort Smith, Arkansas right now." So he kept track of where I was at all times and really enjoyed the fact that I was flying.
Well, we have about 5 more minutes, but I'm curious, though, like, how did your parents handle you not wanting to go to college right away? Because it seemed like that education was high up on their priority list. So how did they handle you not wanting to go?
You know, looking back, that's really funny because, well, I guess they just knew me as I think about it. They knew that as soon, I have the kind of personality that as soon as they say no, I would do it or die. And the hope was, which apparently has worked often in the past, if they say, "Well, it's your decision. We'd rather that you went on to college, but it's your decision," that very often I would think about it and do what they wanted. But this time I didn't. And they didn't pull rank. They really were pretty democratic.
Do you think that helped you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I know it made a difference in the way we raised our son. And because we talked everything through with him, and he was part of all the judgments, and he was just used to that kind of a home and family life, which has worked out well for him. And so I think it probably came from them. One other gift that they gave us, which I didn't realize, but at some point a few years ago, I heard about, somebody was talking about how our family just would criticize and talk. You know, we had roast preacher for lunch on Sunday. And I said to my mother, "You know, I can't remember any time that I ever heard you and Daddy say something unkind about anyone, any kind of cruel gossip or any sort of unkind put down of anyone." I said, "That's really surprising." She said, "No, it isn't. That was a decision that we made not ever to do that in front of your children. Now, we said some things in private, but never in front of your children."
So, I'm not sure if you have anything else you'd like to, if you forgot to work something in. If your parents were here right now, what would you like to say to them?
Oh, well, just thank you. You don't realize what blessings you have till they're gone.
Well, thank you for coming in today.
Oh, my pleasure.